Welcome to Voices,
a podcast from the Institute for Human Rights and Business.
Here, we're seeking to elevate the range of perspectives
on the role of business in the world
and in people's everyday lives.
Hello, everybody. This is Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business, and I'm here today with Scott Edwards, who's a senior advisor on technology, science, and human rights at Amnesty International, at the International Secretariat, but based in Washington. Wonderful to talk to you, Scott. My first question is really about this interplay between technology and human rights. And of course, technology has many implications. And whether it's good or bad, we know that it can be both. Can you tell me what is Amnesty doing in this regard?
I guess on both sides of the coin, looking at the sort of deleterious implications for technology. Certainly we have people who are looking at how technology, say, is enabling human rights perpetrators, say around facial recognition or other forms of surveillance. But most of my work and my team's work centers on using technology for fact-finding purposes.
And how do you go about doing that? Is it something that you do it yourself? Do you depend on others to provide information? Are they technologists themselves? How does it work?
So over the last 10 years or so, we've primarily operated in collaboration with others. So a good example would be Amnesty's early use of remote sensing technology, which at the time I started working with Amnesty was relatively rare in use by human rights organizations. Now, of course, we use it extensively. We use remote sensing data. And as compared to the past, where we'd be in a large partnership, say, with analysts from AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, now we have a satellite imagery analyst on staff within Amnesty. So it mostly proceeds by experimentation, seeing how new information sources, new tools, techniques, and technologies can actually aid in getting to findings of fact. And where the investment warrants it will actually build the capacity within house.
Now, when you look at verification of the data, because there's a lot of data out there which you can source from many sources, how do you verify the information? What are the ways to keep disinformation out of the material that you're getting?
Sure. So, I mean, the first sort of, and it's not dissimilar from traditional ways of collecting information about human rights abuses, which is how certain can you be that the information that you're receiving is what it purports to be. And, you know, when we're interviewing witnesses or collecting witness testimony or victim testimony, we'll do cross-checks to ensure that, you know, it is what it purports to be, that it is true and faithful. So for these new information streams, some of them we can be fairly confident in because they're based on fairly tight controls and rigorous science. If we order an image, a satellite image from Maxar Digital Globe, we can be fairly confident that it is what it purports to be. When we're talking about other types of information that are collected and produced and shared by people who are on the ground, who might be experiencing particular human rights abuses firsthand, obviously those pipelines are places where misinformation or disinformation can be supplied.
Is gaming possible?
Sure, and you can think about all the reasons why somebody would try, or somebody would provide false information. Let's say a photograph that shows something terrible in the context of a crackdown. Who's sharing that and why? Well, it may be people who, you know, are concerned about their loved ones, who want to bring attention to the light of a human rights crisis in its own right. You know, we might run into information that's materials that are false or dishonest in some way by state actors. So there are any number of reasons to deceive, not all of which are sort of evil, air quotes. But what Amnesty has to do in order to protect its mission and its objectivity is to develop the methods, regardless of motivation, to detect material that's false or misleading.
Now, in that context, what do you think is the responsibility of companies, which are the vehicles of these information? I have in mind social media entities like YouTube and Facebook and Google and Twitter, where a lot of this information is widely available and often accurate and often inaccurate.
Sure. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to be very clear, you know, there is no binary true, untrue label that we can assign to information. There are any number of reasons to come across material that might be misleading, such as parody. You know, parody is a useful and,
right.
and important part of expression. Really what Amnesty and other civil society actors are concerned about is the intentional control of narrative by
and manipulation of it.
Manipulation of narrative and manipulation potentially of public opinion. You know, we saw pretty awful examples in the case of Myanmar of the Facebook platform being a conduit for the spread of hate speech and the dehumanization of others. You know, these are clearly organized campaigns, and, you know, that's different than, say, a misleading meme that one's aunt might post to Facebook.
Right, yeah. Now, if you look back at that, and if you can go a bit deeper into it in terms of the corporate responsibility, what do you expect those companies to do? Do you think that they should create a council of wise people, as Facebook is trying to do? Should the state intervene? Should there be more? I mean, it's probably a combination of both, but I'm just trying to tease it out.
So starting backwards, I'm always nervous about state intervention in mediums for expression. And some of the complaints that I've had personally with a YouTube or a Twitter or a Facebook has less to do with their sort of global practices and more to do with their compliance in local jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
So a video that's a perfectly legitimate expression of political speech or something else in the U.S. might be taken down in another country.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be an instance where you see the downsides to state control. My expectations for the companies are not as a matter of policy, but just as a matter of being a good corporate actor, to recognize how your products or your services can be harmful or dehumanizing to others.
Now, and again, if we were to look at the work that Amnesty has done, you spoke very movingly and eloquently about two projects you worked on. If you can just talk a little bit about them. One was a Raqqa, and the other was a trolling example.
Sure. So what we're finding is, whereas in the past it used to be the challenge that we couldn't get access to enough information about, you know, a distant conflict, for instance, we've got the inverse problem now, which is we're overwhelmed with information, tremendous amounts of information, whether it's remote sensing data feeds in the form of satellite images or you know, through aerial photography, or the immense amount of sensor data that's coming off of people's phones in conflict situations such as in Syria. So what Amnesty has launched on is a way to engage its million plus supporters around the world to actually help us sort through this information. And the two cases that you're referencing, one was the case of Raqqa, where over 80% of the city was destroyed.
This is in the Syrian conflict, of course.
Yes,
yeah.
In the coalition strikes and efforts to wrest control from ISIL. And one of the challenges we had is, with 80% of the city destroyed, how can you figure out which buildings were destroyed when, for instance? So what we did was gather a number of time series of satellite images over Raqqa, and we parceled them out, and we asked people globally, tens of thousands of people, to look at a series of images and identify when a particular building had been destroyed. And what this allowed us to do was create a time lapse, basically, of what buildings and blocks and city blocks were targeted when and where. And of course, this isn't just for academic purposes, though it's an important accounting for the historical record.
But it helps build evidence, I take it.
Exactly. So there, you know, maybe if it came to pass that some of these attacks were disproportionate or somehow didn't comply to the rules of war, we'd have more precision in those findings of fact, more precision about the details of that case.
And would you assist with prosecution, or would you use it only as a way to lobby and advocate a particular position?
You know, as a global answer, justice and accountability is an important part of protection of human rights. Amnesty is an independent organization, and of course we respect the independence of judicial mechanisms. So to say we would support any particular defense or prosecution,
yeah.
I think our role, especially in the case of these armed conflicts, is to provide objective, unbiased, and precise reporting on the impacts. And of course we'll have policy calls when it appears that justice isn't being met, such as we've done in Syria, requesting for ICC investigations.
And if you can talk a little bit about the misogyny on internet, that also on which you have worked using these new means.
Yeah, so sure. One of the challenges, you know, everybody is speaking about the promise of artificial intelligence and algorithms to deal with these information challenges, these overload challenges, but they're problematic for a few reasons, and a great example of that is the fact that computers are terrible with context. They don't understand. I could show a computer security forces wrestling a man to the ground, and then a father and children play wrestling, and it couldn't tell the difference. Same thing with language. Algorithms are not very good in detecting things such as misogyny, for instance. So one of the other crowd-tasking projects that Amnesty undertook was to evaluate millions of tweets that were directed at female politicians or journalists in Europe and elsewhere, and to actually quantify and determine whether tweets were misogynistic or somehow problematic. And what that allowed us to do, which was probably not a surprise to most involved, is actually detail precisely how much misogynistic, hateful, or otherwise denigrating speech is directed to women leaders, women politicians, and journalists. And we actually were able to do in-sample sort of assessments and identify racial disparities in that directed speech, highlighting, of course, that Twitter could be doing more.
Yeah. No, one interesting thing I found when you made your presentation, and it occurs to me now as we speak, is that when it came to the people who are identifying specific remarks as misogynist was, in a sense, crowdsourced, because it was your supporters from around the world doing it, and they had a similar view on what is and what is not misogynistic. So when people say that these things are culturally relative and not universal, that's not really true, isn't it? That certain things are universal abuses, even if they are abuses of expression.
Yeah, and, you know, it's, yes, so much of language, which is, again, why it's difficult for machines, is culturally or contextually dependent, but it's in context. Even if a particular derogatory word is not used, the human mind is able to, they're able to induce what a misogynistic comment might be. For all of these projects, whether it's looking at satellite imagery or assessing misogynistic content, whatever it might be, we do provide, you know, tutorials, information, education to those participants. Because a particular word may not be offensive, you know, or misogynistic in your neighborhood, but understanding when directed in the context of women politicians in Europe, that word may take on a different meaning,
for instance. Thank you very much, and all the best with your extremely important work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.